Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I think to understand where we are now, we have to understand where we've been, and I'm going to have to explain what's going on in our industry because that will hopefully clarify it. My mantra has always been afflict the comfortable, comfort the afflicted. Tell me something I don't know, and don't take yes for an answer. That's what I tell the people I work with. That's what I tell the young college students that intern in our unit, that you have to be aggressive and seek the truth. And speaking of seeking the truth, I was looking through my old textbook last night as I was preparing to speak. This was my kind of my Bible when I was going to college. It came out about the time Woodward and Bernstein were doing their thing at Watergate. And a lot of us in the business now were impressed with what they did, and that's got motivated a lot of us. But then I recalled when I was taking this class that actually investigative journalism has been around a long time. As he mentioned, Teddy Roosevelt called them muckrakers. And in the late 19th, early 20th century, there were magazine writers, reporters, journalists, print people, and even novelists who were doing exposés on slums, child labor law, food processing plants. I kept thinking, more things change, the more they remain the same, don't they? I mean, we still have the same ills because humans being humans still have the same weaknesses. So they were chasing it 100 years ago. We're chasing it now. And, of course, a lot of the parameters have changed. And bear with me. I just wanted to read you this. I remember reading the quote last night. It's Teddy Roosevelt. They should have a Teddy Roosevelt Award for investigative journalism because he was a little ticked off at journalists because they're a little bit cynical and pessimistic, but you got to be that way. But if you don't mind, let me just read this. There are in the bloody politic, economic and social, many and grave evils. And there is an urgent necessity for the sternest war upon them. There should be relentless exposure of and attack upon every evil man, whether politician or businessman, every evil practice, whether in politics, in business, or in social life. I hail as a benefactor every writer or speaker, every man or woman, I added that, who on the platform or in book, magazine, or newspaper, and broadcast, and internet, with merciless severity makes such attacks, provided always that he is in his turn remembers that the attack is of use only if it is absolutely truthful. That's Teddy Roosevelt. And that was kind of the mantra. That all came back last night preparing for this. But since then, he mentioned some of the people that have carried the banner. It comes and goes. It's popular and it isn't popular for a while, investigative journalism. And I remember that one person, I was reflecting back on Ida Tarbell. If you ever have a chance, read about this lady. She did a series of magazine articles about Standard Oil, you know, Rockefellers, you know, Exxon, you know, huge profits in the quarter. And she was one of the first muckrakers. And I had admired her work. And she was one of the people I wanted to fashion my career after. I didn't always walk in a straight line, but I am where I am now. And, of course, Seymour Hersh, fast forward to today. And even here in town, Marcus Stern, who worked for the UT in Washington Bureau, which has since been closed by Copley, he did the Duke Cunningham scandal. So it is alive and well. It's just changing. Right now, my industry, the media industry, broadcast, print, is in the most dramatic change it's been in since I've been in the business, which is 30 years now. And there's a lot of reasons for that. It's like the financial markets turmoil in some ways because it's so profound in what is happening. While the financial markets is a much tighter time frame, what's going on. I mean, this thing's been crazy for just a short period of time. This is what's been evolving in the media business, too, over the last 3 to 5 years. It's bought on by the wireless internet revolution. And they have two things in common. You know, today they were talking, I don't know if you were listening to the radio, about how the global markets are collapsing, and because we're all interconnected. And a lot of that's got to do with communication. A lot of they got instant access of information across borders. For us, it's the same thing, except it's the internet. And it's the internet has just had a profound and dramatic change. I would argue with people it's as dramatic as the invention of the printing press for the ability to communicate to many people some thoughts and ideas. But instead of having to print the paper out and distribute it, it's instantaneous. It's instantaneous. What it's done is fragmented the audience into tiny niches, which means our advertisers have fragmented it into tiny niches. Their advertisers are chasing the audience, and instead of spending the money with the three big networks, now they have it all over the place. And the amount of money going for newspaper advertising and television revenue has been spiraling like that. Why do I mention it? It has an effect on my job in investigative reporting. For instance, I imagine a number of you have been here for a while. It wasn't that long ago before we had the Union, the Trib, the LA Times, the Escondido Times Advocate, the Daily Californian, the Vista Press, daily newspapers in this market. Now we have the Union Tribune, and it's up for sale. That's not all because of the internet, but the internet is driving it. For the broadcast industry, let's see, when I came to work, it was KGTV, KFMB, KNST, or they were KCST back then. That was my competition. We had a big fat pie and times were good. What happened now is we've got cable, MSNBC, Fox, CNN Headline, CNN Regular, three other independents in the market, Fox, KUSI, and the WB, all competing for that same piece of pie, plus the internet, plus the cable channels. So it's gotten much more difficult. The structure that has been created over many years is crumbling. It's not working. That particular structure, it doesn't work. And anybody in my business, you hear a lot about the newspapers, the newspaper people whining about the layoffs, but we're going through it too. Constrictions on staff, do more with less, add news shows. Obviously, when you do more with less, you affect quality. Anyway, it's put a real squeeze on us. You remember when you used to go out and get your evening newspaper or you could have your morning paper or come home and watch TV at 5 and watch the news or 6, sit down with your family? All those habits are gone. Now our client base, I hope not for all of you people though, please, but our client base now is a great deal of it wants their news and they want it now and they want when they're ready to get it. So again, that's causing a dramatic shift in this and how business is done. And it's tough on the news providers to figure out how to do this, whether you're broadcast, print. How do we do this? Do we do it on cell phones? Do we send it on iPods? What are we going to do? How we do it? We're right in that evolvement now. And what form should that be for viewers and readers? Should it be text? Should it be video? How do we do this? So we're all wrestling with this. The bottom line is we call it appointment viewing or appointment reading. There's less of that now, much less. The older demographics still are going to do more traditional viewing of the broadcast news and reading their newspaper, but that's changing, and there's not much we can do about it. It's coming on hard. It's led to staff cuts, as I told you, a squeeze on the bottom line. Now we come to the payoff. Well, what does that mean for investigative journalism? Well, to set the stage, how is investigative journalism, at least in the broadcast end and the print end, because I have a wife who's a print reporter, so I'm very familiar with their industry. Hi. And with a regular reporter in the newspaper, a regular TV person, you cover the daily news. There's a fire, you send the crew. And thanks. Thank you very much. you send the crew, and you shoot the flames, you tell the story, you talk to the victims, you come home, and it's over with. With a newspaper, you send the reporter out, you get the quotes, you get the photog, the shoot pictures of the flames, you come back, and you tell the story. Excuse me. But investigative journalism, as you would imagine, is a lot more than that. The way our unit works is we get a tip from a citizen like yourself, from a government worker, from a guy in a corporation, somebody at a nonprofit. They said, you ought to check this out. Part of the problem now is a lot of state agencies don't do anything. They even refer people to us because they're overwhelmed. So we have the investigative unit, our unit at least, gets tons of information coming in all the time. And I'm kind of the gatekeeper. It comes through my funnel, and I look at it and try to figure out what are we going to try to chase. And then if we decide to chase it, then we have these bright kids, college interns. This is the only way we could do this, who want to be investigative journalists too or reporters. And we put them in a very narrow box of things they can chase. And we say we want to this letter, let me think of one we're doing. Okay, we got a mortgage fraud case we're working on right now, another one. And we tell them, contact the victim, take their message, pull the law on it. What else do we do? Pull the law on it. Find out information on the internet, anything you can about our target. Background the target for me. And so they do that stuff. I used to do that myself. My producers would do that, and they still do on some stories, depending on the sensitivity. But now we have the college kids doing it. Then they bring the packet to us, evaluate it. I sit with them and the reporter and say, okay, what do we got? What do you think? And then we move forward. And then it becomes even more sophisticated as we check some of the key things, particularly anything we're going to air, and move forward with the piece. We don't have the luxury of doing one of these at a time. Right now in our coming down the pipeline for November, I have 16 stories. That's an incredible amount of investigative stories. But that's because November is when they do the sweeps thing that you always hear about, ratings. And if they're going to spend that much money on a unit of our size, they want it where it will benefit the company. And that's when the metering service counts how many people are watching your newscasts. That's a fact of life for us. We do things out of the sweeps, but for the most part, we focus on the sweeps. Some broadcast and print investigation teams will focus on the big story. And some investigative units will focus, like we do, we look for the big story, but while we're looking for the big story, we're moving little stories through. I was going to show you a couple tapes, but I messed up and the DVD is not ready. But it was example of one was the little story we did was on you can order your tickets for events off the internet. You know, you can order something for a concert you want to go to and they print it at home and you have that. Well, people were turning around and selling those to people, running an ad in Craigslist, and they have the printout for the ticket. And people would buy them from them. So they would sell that same ticket to make 10 people. You know, they meet them at a gas station in Encinitas. And we were trying to warn people, don't be stupid. Don't do that. Those tickets can be duplicated. You don't know till you get to the gate. And we found out when, like, four people had the same ticket to go to a off-road thing at Qualcomm or something like that. All four of them happened to call us. And they eventually caught one of the guys, and they're looking for another one. But that's a quick hit, what I call a quick hit. That wasn't months of research. That was a duh. But we felt like we had to get it out there. The other one I was going to show you is we did a story last May, I think, or was it November? I don't remember. But about all the ordnance that lays buried in the county. And it's called FUDs. And it was an incredible amount of work because of the amount of information out there and the lack of information on the location of where the ordnance is buried. This is ordnance that was used in the Korean War. All the firing ranges and the artillery ranges that were around here after World War II, a lot of that ordnance wasn't picked up. It isn't like it is now where you would they're all over the military if they don't pick up the ordnance. Back then, they did a quick check. They said, one guy told me it was like looking for cigarette butts They did that kind of a check of the grounds, and then the military moved out. So all that ordnance is buried, and there's a great deal of ordnance buried in the county all over the place. Every once in a while, something happens, blows up, fires set it off. I think the UT did a story recently about firemen concerned about the ordnance out there. That took a long time. But that's an example of – that's how I'm able to make our unit survive, because I provide the people that I work for a lot of stories – and then I try to weigh the long form story with a short form story. That's not to say everything's the same for every broadcast station and news station in the country. But I am lucky in that my company realizes that one of the biggest complaints about broadcasting news is, oh, it's all the same. Every station you turn to, they have the same stuff. Well, a lot of that's because the same stuff's happening on the same day. But viewers perceive it as, oh, they have that fire, and these guys have that fire if they're clicking. I hate those channel clickers. Anyway, and they think it's all the same. And what investigative reporting does allow us to do is differentiate ourselves. And so while the reason we're doing it's important to the community, it's also important for our company's brand that they know they come to us, we're going to give them investigative stuff, because that's what we've been doing for a long time. I used to work with Marty Emerald. She's a troubleshooter. She's running for city council now, and I can't even talk about it, so I won't. So why would you hire an investigative reporter? They have to be experienced. You can't have those kids. You see a lot of kids on TV today, believe me. I don't know half of the reporters in the market anymore. I used to. You still see some veterans. So an investigative reporter has got to have experience. You can't have a kid doing this. You're going to end up getting sued. And there's so many bad things that could happen. So you got to have a pro. Pros cost more money. You have to have time. You need time. You need resources. You need to be able to fail. In other words, you need to chase a story. And if the story isn't there, you dump it. You don't need the pressure of management saying, well, you spent, $2,000 getting these parts, and you spent a month shoot, and it's not going to run. Now, you got to have the ability to fail and be able to back off from a story. A lot of places won't do that. It's not cost effective. The other concern is attorneys. This is a very litigious society. I'm sure you all know that. And I get a letter a week from an attorney threatening this or that. I've developed a thick skin, but I pay attention. And if you're not ready to fight for your stories with the people that would not like to see those stories air, then you're not going to succeed. If you end up doing stories where you only attack little defenseless individuals or people, like somebody does over on another station, I won't mention his name, it starts with a T, and doesn't usually take on the bigger problems in the institutions, well, that's easy to do. Well, you're not going to be hassled by the attorneys. But sometimes you got to go after the big guys. Sometimes you got to be willing to stick your neck out. Sometimes you got to tell a tough story that maybe an advertiser doesn't like, which recently happened to us. I won't go into details, but it's a major hospital chain in town that punished us for a story and withdrew a great deal of advertising dollars in a tough time. But my management said the story is righteous. You did the right thing. But that kind of pressure may be at another place that doesn't have a tradition, a culture of understanding what it takes to do investigative reporting. They may fold up. Maybe a news station like the WB, they start an investigative unit. Attorneys start bugging them. They start threatening to pull advertising. What do you think is going to happen? They're going to bail, given the conditions of the market now. I mean, you have to fight for every advertising dollar, and these guys are threatening you, which makes it tough for a for-profit like ourselves, unless there's a strong commitment, a strong culture of support for investigative reporting. So what's evolved is there's been the growth of what they call the nonprofits. Now, I don't know how many of you heard of ProPublica. Have anybody here heard of ProPublica? Okay. How many of you read Voice of San Diego? Do you? Oh, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Listen, those guys are pretty good. What they've done is they are a nonprofit. They found people who would support them. So they don't have advertisers. They have a very small staff. My I team is as big as the staff at Voice. And what they do is then they go after targets like the Union Tribune would be reluctant to do or was reluctant to do for many years. That's why they broke the story on Southeast Development Corporation. I don't know if you knew about that one. That was The Voice did that. And what ProPublica is, I want to get the names right, so bear with me as I go through my notes. But ProPublica was these Herbert and Marion Sandler, the former executives of Golden West Financial Corporation. They've committed $10 million a year to a project called ProPublica based out of New York. And what these guys will do is they have a staff of investigative reporters, and they'll provide the investigative reports for free, and they partner around the country with mainly the big players. They call, they won't even return my calls, but they like 60 Minutes. They hooked up with 60 Minutes. Their first story was with 60 Minutes. They did one with the New York Times. In fact, one of the more important editors at the UT left the UT, her name was Susan White, to go work for ProPublica to help them. And so there is a lot of talk in my business, so maybe the nonprofit is a solution. Or maybe blogs. Maybe blogs are the answer. But wait a minute. What do those guys that write those blogs know about the subject? And what's going to happen to that blogger the first time some big law firm from downtown San Diego sends one of these three-page letters demanding 25 things and telling them they're about to get their tail sued? What happens to the bloggers? It costs a lot of money to do investigative reporting. There are some bloggers in town that do a good job, but they can't, I don't think they can cover the whole field. But what I do see evolving is maybe a mix of some for-profit places like 10 News that are committed to this, and the Union Tribune. Let me give you a little sidebar. They recently had layoffs, and they offered buyouts. And the only people was one group of people they would not offer a buyout to were the investigative team from the newspaper. So the newspaper realizes, too, hey, this is what sets us apart from the weekly. We're able to do things like this. So there's a recognition in the industry, this is important, that we need to keep it going. But how do we do it? Well, the nonprofit model, like The Voice, like ProPublica, but you got to have people with deep pockets ready to back that. Or the commercial entities like us, but you have to have a culture. All I know is we need to keep doing it. It's important to the community. We got to keep the other guys honest. We got to keep an eye on things. We don't always get it right. We sure missed it on the financial thing. Only the Wall Street Journal was hammering the financial story. And there's a lot of stuff we could have done that we didn't do that I have regrets. But we still have to make the effort because I think we have a responsibility to the public to tell them what is going on in the community, the money they pay for their taxes, where that's going, and don't let anybody have a free ride. They're not entitled to a free ride. It's not written in their contract. When they were born, they got a free ride. And so we do need investigative reporting, and hopefully it'll evolve with these three different elements, or two elements really, into something that's viable into the future. But I would encourage you to, if you enjoy investigative reporting, support the people that do it, voice your displeasure if people stop doing it. They'll pay attention to you help this thing survive. It is important to the community. I believe in it. I deeply believe in it. It's been in this country for 110 years. We've exposed a lot of things that weren't right, and hopefully we can keep doing it. That's my hope and my prayer. And we have a lot of young children, young students coming up now that seem to have the fire in their belly too, and I'd hate to have the not for them to have the ability to do the same kind of work that I've been lucky and blessed to do for investigative reporting for about 23 years. So, thanks.
Do you have any comments on the fairness doctrine that the broadcasters are particularly bothered about?
Which one? I'm sorry?
The fairness doctrine, by which they want whether it's right-wing or left-wing broadcasters, and they're talking about on the internet, to always present the other side of the story, which is going to mean pretty much the end for many, many talk shows.
Well, no. But what are they going to resurrect and reinforce the fairness doctrine again?
Well, there's a threat. Democrats are very much behind enforcing it.
Yeah, well, we'll see. God, every time I hear a rumor or something like that, I just wait to see what happens. I found out people throw a lot of stuff out there to see what sticks to the wall, and see if somebody will bite on it, and then see what happens. I mean, our administrations do it all the time. Our politicians do it all the time. People with axes to grind do it all the time. I don't think they're going to be reinforcing it. There's just too many media outlets. How are you going to do that? The Democrats are mad because of the right-wing talk radio. Well, then get left-wing talk radio. Plus, I know. I'm very familiar with it. I have a good friend with Bree Walker who did left-wing radio in L.A. for a while, and she's very active in it. But I think, to balance it, I think the left is much more powerful on the Internet because they seem to be connecting with people. So Rush Limbaugh is screaming in the wilderness on radio to the people, and his audience is dropping, and the Internet has had a profound effect. I've been talking about it, and I think that's where some of the balance is coming in. It was never planned that way, but it just seems to be working out that way. There seems to be more left blogging and not a lot. I mean, Sledge, there are some from the right, too, that are pretty have a good following. But the left has done pretty well on the Internet. I hope that answers your question. I wasn't trying to cop out. I don't think it's going to be an issue after the election.
Hi.
Hi.
At the San Diego Press Club this week, the new president made a speech and talked about how it's perhaps time to fight back, for the media to fight back against people who rant and rail against the press, and talk about how important freedom of the press is to democracy. And I was wondering if you would care to comment on that, and if you can name some ways that the press can fight back.
I was there at the press club thing. Our team won a few awards, by the way. Best investigative series, never mind. And I agreed with them. Honest, sometimes I get so tired of people blaming us for all the problems of the world. You know, we are just the messenger. And you may not believe the message, or you're angry about this message. Oh, Prop 8, my God. That thing is, we're catching it from both sides. No matter how we write a story, one side or the other is growling at us. It's one of those divisive issues that has everybody interested in what's going on. And that's one where they're blaming the messenger. Whatever you do, why, by golly. And blaming the messenger is a cop-out, I think. And honest, I am. I'm sick of it. But when people call me and start yelling about content, I'll hang up on them. If they'll talk to me civilly about a story and they have issues with it, I'll engage them, because I'm not saying we're right all the time. We certainly aren't right all the time. But most of us are professionals. We care about our job. We want to be fair to both sides. We don't want to destroy somebody's life. We don't want to ruin somebody's business. But we do search for the truth. And if we don't do it, who's going to do it? I don't know of any other mechanism out there. But it does get old. I don't know how we fight back. Hey, I went to this job because I want this job. I can take the heat. If I do a story and I screw up, I'm going to say I screwed up. But I'm going to defend it, too. And if somebody gets in my face about it, I'm going to get back in their face. My boss doesn't always like that. But I feel passionately about what I do. And I think we have to take it. That's part of the job. You just have to grow a thick skin, though it does get old. And I wish once in a while people would say, hey, that's a pretty good story. Thank you very much. We appreciate what you did. But we don't get pats on the back. But we're not paid for it. We're paid to look for the truth.
How do you explain the explosion of local news? I mean, at 7 in the morning, you can look at 6 channels or at 10 or 11. I mean, there's a heck of a lot of competition out there. What do you do to stay ahead, or how do you look at these new channels, or what's going on there? Is a lot of money to be made there?
Well, the money's getting less and less. It was a big fat pie before, and there's a lot of money. And they add the channel, they add the news because they can make more money that way. It's still it's still the only product that our local TV stations put out. We're not producing Broadway plays or sitcoms. It's news is our product. So if your money is shrinking, what do? You add more newscasts. We added one. I don't think the strategy works. There's too much out there. We added one at 7 p.m. that's doing really well. I agreed with that one. In fact, I've been arguing for years when I was out on the freeway at 6 o'clock at night. I'm saying, why the hell do we have the news on at 6 o'clock? Look at all these people driving home. And so our 7's doing good, but all those early morning newscasts and all of that stuff. But the problem is if you give up a newscast, then the other guys get that audience, and the concern is that other audience will stay with them for the other newscasts. So we're on this treadmill right now, keep adding newscasts and waiting for all the stuff to shake out. We have a 5 a.m., 6 a.m., 11 to 12, 5 to 6, 6 to 6:30. And the 7 o'clock and the 11 p.m. That's a lot of news. A lot of news.
I appreciate the channel 210, so if I want to tune
Thank
in at
you.
Any time.
Is that 210? You're on Time Warner?
Yes, but
Thank
last
you.
Night it wasn't there. Have you taken it off? It was a blank screen.
Oh, it might be technical. I can ask, but as far as I know, it's still going. I'm a Cox cable person. It's on 110, but... Not 210. I'll ask an engineer when I get back what's going on. Call us when stuff like that happens. And for goodness sakes, you see something going on in the community, call us. You won't believe how accessible we are. They'll put you right into the news desk and you can talk to an editor. That's how we get a lot of our stories. Just people. How else are we going to get it? The AP can't cover the whole community.
How much pressure do you get from management to, most newspapers are slanted, either Republican or Democrat. Are you free to do the story the way you want, or do you get pressure from Mr. Copley or whoever?
No, I'm Mr. Copley is the Union Tribune. I am Mr. McGraw-Hill. Well, does this thing go back to the East Coast, the tape? Okay. No, okay. We work for here. It's a blessing and a curse. We work for a corporate company based in New York. The only time I have to talk to New York is when we have lawyers on the staff, thank God, that on the New York staff that I talk to on stories, because I worry about some stories and I am not a lawyer, and there's some things I have to be very careful of, and that is the only time they get involved in this. I have never had New York call me. I've had the GM call me a couple times, but that's their job. But I've never been told to kill a story. I've never been told to change the direction of the story. But nobody from the sales department will talk to me right now, and I don't know what that's about.
Truth. I worked for McGraw-Hill for 8 years in the 1950s.
Oh.
They were okay. There was a real wall, a big wall between
yes.
advertising and editorial. I was on the editorial side. So that's a plug for McGraw-Hill.
Thank you. They are. There is a big wall there. But they really respect it. They're old school First Amendment people. And for that, I'm very lucky.
I always enjoy reading some of the stories in the Reader. And maybe you'll notice that they offer a $25 finder's fee for some inside information. What are your comments about they're doing that, you know, paying a bribe? Or have you ever been asked to give money for story?
Oh, yes.
Tell
All
us
the
about
time,
that.
People. Well, that's how the Reader works. We would never do that. I couldn't offer people 25 bucks for a tip. That would be... unless it's at Del Mar. But it better win. I just couldn't do it. I feel real uneasy. Recently, we had a guy who, and I never ran this down. I'm just going to tell you something that may be just gossip. But he had a bullet in his head, and there was a lot of interest in the stories. I don't know all the ins and outs because the unit wasn't involved in it. But the bottom line is we heard a network was paying him $500 for the exclusive. Sometimes some of the network people will offer money for an interview. our policies don't do it. I mean, it's a slippery slope. I don't want to get into that. You know, that's, it makes me uncomfortable, very uncomfortable.
Are you able to comment on any significant differences between investigative reporting in this country and the very aggressive Fleet Street organization?
You call that investigative reporting on Fleet Street? What the Queen is wearing in her bedroom? Who did Princess Diane see before she died? They're pretty aggressive, but those are, you know, there's some Murdoch people out there, and those guys don't do a lot of investigative reporting. I mean, they have a different style than we do. That's not to say they're not good ones. I know some British fellas who do investigative reporting. It's very interesting at the station. The State Department sends in visiting journalists. They pay for visiting journalists to come, and I always get to see them when they're coming through and talking to them about what it's like in their country right now. And investigative journalists, a broadcast, print, regular journalists. And the amazing thing, I talked to journalists recently from the Ukraine and Korea and Japan, and they are going through the same things we are with the Internet. We started talking. They said the same thing. The way the model was set up is not working now, and they can't figure out what to do. And there are some great investigative journalists in other countries. I'm a member of Investigative Reporters and Editors, IRE.org. Check it out sometime. They have members all over the world. And I'll tell you, some of the bravest ones right now are in Mexico. We were just down there. I can tell you now, we were down there recently, but we get in there and get out of there because I'm not, the situation is scary down there. I don't care what the Tourism Bureau says. You don't know. I mean, things are just weird. A lot of strange things going on. But I know some Mexican journalists it takes courage to call, because these guys, I mean, where do you go to hide? They have no place to hide.
When the Pentagon Papers were trying to get published, and many, many newspapers were asked to take them and refused until the New York Times did.
And the Washington Post almost soon right after.
But where is the courage in the newspapers to really, really investigate something that was so, so important?
Well, that was a time frame that was the reason I got into it, because they did have courage to do that kind of stuff. Yeah, they do need that, don't they? And what's the matter with the Washington Press Corps anyway? It's like they're more interested in sitting in that room and maybe being on TV and going along. And shame on them. But there are good people out there, too. They try to make a difference. It's just that sometimes they're like a lonely voice. And now the problem is there's so much noise out there and so many other voices. How do you weed through all that stuff to find the person that's telling it like it is? How do you find a Woodward and Bernstein or a Walter Cronkite? Because everybody's pounding their chest and say, I got the answers. I'm the one with the answers. Nobody has all the answers, but it's a trying time for the country and for our industry.
What advice would you give to a young person who wanted to become a journalist today? Would you suggest they go to journalism school, or is that all old-style journalism? Should they concentrate on the Internet? What would you suggest?
What would a young journalist do?
Or a wannabe journalist?
Be born to rich parents is my suggestion. Look, you're not going to make a lot of money in this business. Nobody makes a lot of money. Even the anchors don't make big money anymore, folks. That's the clue. It's tough. But, in fact, last night I was at SDSU talking to a bunch of young journalists who want to get in the business. And if I'll repeat kind of what I told them. What's going on in the business is because of the Internet. In fact, our station did this. And maybe I'll back up even a little bit more. It used to be when you go out on a news story, you'd have a cameraman, you'd have his grip or audio guy, and you'd have the reporter. You have three people going out to cover one story. Most news stations get two stories out of that team that day. So you have three people getting two stories. What our station did, if I may brag on them a bit, is decide to cross-train these people. That grip editor, audio guy is older now. Now he's a regular shooter. The other shooter's a shooter, and you have that reporter. We trained the reporter to shoot. We trained the photographer and the former editor, grip photographer, to write. We gave them small cameras. So now the theory was that these three people are now turning six stories a day. Maybe this one doesn't have to turn that one day, and they have 2 days to turn it. We call it a digital correspondent program. If you watch our news, you hear them referencing it. At first, it was very rough. You don't learn writing that quickly. You don't learn to shoot that well that quickly. We kind of rode the storm. Everybody in the market attacked us. My news director at that time had to go to Las Vegas and defend the station at a big television mucky-muck thing. And you know what? We get the last laugh because the industry is now shifted that way. KNSD is starting to do it. ABC Overseas is doing it. CBS owned and operated stations are doing it in order to put more people on the street. So what that says to a young journalist is, I just can't learn writing now. I can't be an anchor and stand there, and that's my gig. I have to learn how to shoot. I learn how to edit. I have to learn how to blog. Two writing styles. Blogging is not the same as broadcast writing. Completely different. Broadcast, short declarative sentence. Print writing is different. And I need to be able to load the stuff into the system. I need to be able to take video. They're even doing this at the UT. My wife shoots video for the UT and writes for the paper, too. She's there on the weekends editing stuff and driving me crazy with questions. But you do that to survive, and I would tell that, hey, you got to be versatile. You got to be able to walk into a shop and say, I can do it all. Give me a daggone camera and a laptop, and I'll go out and bring you back two stories today. And that's what they're going to be looking for, and it's not going to change. But that means, I hope, when these kids are coming through the system, they're well-grounded in ethics of journalism and responsibilities of journalism. Well, I had those.
Learn all these different techniques
in journalism school? Well, now the universities are catching up. Actually, they're behind the curve. They're not really up to speed yet, but I keep preaching this every time I go over to my alma mater, San Diego State, and they have begun a multimedia program to try to train the kids to be as versatile as they can in order to survive and have a marketable skill in the marketplace.
What is your position on the SHIELD law as it applies to people that you obtain information from? And what is the position of the company you work for with regards to talking to informants?
That's a great question for me. God bless the California SHIELD law. You know, and the federal SHIELD law is being looked at now. What the SHIELD law is, if you don't know, is we have the right to protect. They can't compel us, except in certain cases, to tell law enforcement who our sources are. That's important. That's what the California SHIELD law has. I've got a tattered copy in my wallet if you want to see it. And it's my bread and butter. Imagine how many investigative pieces I would do if the cops could come to me and say, well, who did you talk to in that story? Or who's your source on that? However, like everything else it seems to be anymore, the judges and the courts weigh heavily on the right of people to have a fair trial. And sometimes they compel a reporter to testify to something or provide information when the information is available elsewhere. And frankly, I think they do it to prove a point. You're not going to tell this judge what he can and cannot do. You're going to tell us, even though the DA may have or the defense attorney may have the ability and the means to get the information, they rather make us sweat in a box. And it really, it's wrong. We have to have the ability to talk to our sources. We have to have the ability to say, hey, don't worry. We're not going to tell people who you are. We're getting ready to do a story on what's going down in Mexico, and I'm using a confidential source. If I had to give that source up, one, I'd probably endanger this person's life. And secondly, I swore to him that I would never reveal who they are. What if a judge says, well, something happens and somebody dies and the judge wants to know, okay, who are you talking to that knows about this information and what's going on down there? I would not want to tell him. I think I have as a journalist responsibility to protect my sources. I believe in that. They can drag me off. I really believe in that. I got involved in a weird case about 15 years ago with a guy named David Allen Lucas. He was one of our serial killers here. And I got involved in it because it's a long, weird story. But the bottom line was the defense attorney thought I knew about a sheriff's undercover investigation of David Allen Lucas. He would go and slit women's throats, and he was a painter. And he's on death row now, but he killed four or five women. And I got in a position where the judge was telling me, you got to tell me who your source is. When the fact of the matter was, it was completely, these guys were way off base, but I couldn't say anything. I did have sources in the sheriff's department. I wasn't about to open up the book and tell that. So I went through that, and I packed a toothbrush. The case is David Allen Lucas. Google it sometime. It's a weird one. I don't know why they haven't got that guy in the chamber already, frankly. He was an evil, evil guy. And the hook on the story, if you want to go see, is I sent a camera crew to his house a month or two before the cops caught him to do an interview. Try to figure that one out.
Do you, with respect to informants that you mentioned will be held, their names will be held in confidence, do you describe in detail to your bosses, to people in management, who your informants are? And as a second part, what do you tell the prospective informant as to the kinds of protection you will be able to give him?
I can only talk about my perspective. I've been there long enough that my bosses trust me. And some of the informants we use, I would be uncomfortable with sending emails and memos out to people about them. Not that I don't trust people that I work for, but the less known about somebody like that, the more secure they are. When someone comes to me, here's how we do on-camera interview now. We don't even use real audio of their voice, because we did a story once and we found out a certain government agency, we did electronically distorted the voice. We found out that it was dumb of us, because we found out the agencies have the ability to undistort the voice. So now you see us doing undercover and you hear a voice, what we do is we transcribe what they say word for word and then use somebody else's voice to really screw them up, and then they try to figure out what's going on. And we don't show the face. We don't show parts of the hands that may give them away. Even you talk to somebody for a while, they have certain mannerisms when they talk. They may say, blah, 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 We take all that stuff out because we're really, really careful, because I feel responsible. Somebody loses their job. Somebody ends up dead. Somebody's husband finds them when they're trying to hide out from them, all of that stuff. So I'm pretty careful. Now, sometimes I tell them to not so much to protect myself. It may be something that is a little scary or freaky, and that I will tell them, okay, I'm talking to this person. This is what it's about. I'd like you to know about this in case anything weird comes down. I'll do that occasionally, but that doesn't happen very often. And then when I have a source, I tell them, but just as I told you, how we hide the faces, the voices. My researchers are never allowed to give anybody the right of confidentiality. I tell them, as part of their training, you can't do that. That has to come from me, because once we give promise somebody confidentiality, that is a contract. And if that name gets out, they can sue us. That's happened before in the country, where they promised confidentiality and the editors decided that who it was as important as the story. So the editors printed who the confidential source was, and they got their butts sued, rightly so, and lost. So we have a contract when we say we're not going to reveal your name. And I've been lucky it hasn't happened. I try to be as careful as I can. And because of that, I have lots of people coming here, and trust me, I have people all over the community that work in positions that will go to with me to the grave that are very helpful to tell me things, that they trust me, I trust them. It's a matter of confidence in each other, of keeping your words, keeping your being an honorable person.
You got another question, Barry?
This guy's a journalist? Or
he's a lawyer.
Identify
Watch
yourself.
Out. Watch out, he's a lawyer.
But
he's a
Uh-oh.
Lawyer. He's not, the not the other kind.
Uh-oh.
You're not the other kind, are you, Barry?
Oh, are you representing somebody that we're doing a story about, may I ask? Or have done a story about? No, you got to tell me. Are you representing somebody we did a story about?
No.
Okay.
But what I do, what I did or did before I retired is not really relevant these questions or your talk at all.
All right, sir.
But as a matter of interest to the general public and certainly to those in this classroom, you are no doubt a very trustworthy reporter, but in light of the position that you hold on the subject of confidentiality, including, in fact, holding that information as close to your vest as you possibly can, what assurance does the public have when it reads reports or news or columns from other reporters who might take a similar position to you, that the story, in fact, is not an invention?
That's an excellent question. And we know that it has happened where they make up people. But I don't think you see a lot of – this may be a little weak defense, but you usually don't see veterans that have been in the business a long time doing that. It's usually some kid coming up that wants to make a name themselves, have been in the business 4 or 5 years. I myself have a system where I keep track of who they are and what they are and where the information is, and it's a safe place. But that's a good question. It comes down to the editors making sure the people that they have are ethical, that they watch what they're writing about. When there's things that don't make sense, they question them. Be leery of people that are interested in moving up the ladder in a hurry, because sometimes they don't care, just like any business, what it takes to get there. I have to ask people to trust me. That's the only thing I can do, because I can't live without confidential sources. I might as well be covering fires. Or an accident on 805, because without confidential sources, I go bye-bye. I'm not going to get information from the government employees if they're going to get fired. And, you know, they're a GS-14, and they got their career riding on, and they have the courage enough to come forward and say something. I mean, so that's a good question. That's a quandary, and I think that one will be on the table 10 years from now, especially with the Internet. I mean, that just makes it even more wide open, because these people doing blogs or Internet pieces, well, what are their sources and what's their training? And are they trained in ethics? And how long have they been doing this? And what's their, you know, what axe are they trying to grind? All things the way. Thank you. Good, nice question. I liked it.
Yes, I have a question regarding the role of newspapers in the media. It used to be that we had a national dialogue that was conducted through television, through the newspapers. Matter of fact, we even watched the same television program at the same time, and the water pressure dropped when they got a bathroom break. But now, this factor that you mentioned before, the isolation or the talking only to each other, who's going to force the issue of having a battleground for the public debate? Now, to give you what I'm talking about, in the campaign, this inevitable, this long-running campaign that we've had for the presidency did one thing. On the one hand, we had all the trivia that was brought up, and I blame the media partly for that. They just shouldn't print the damn stuff. It's not significant. But on the other hand, it also did eventually reach a point where I think the people are educated on it. How can we maintain that kind of exchange, because it's going to be very necessary from here on out?
Oh. That's for a professor here. Matt is a tough one, but do we have a professor? Well, I mean, first off, how many things reach the level of importance and scrutiny as a presidential election? That's one of the issues. When you have all the eyeballs watching, I think this financial thing, I hope we keep the heat up and keep the cameras on, and those guys are swarming them, because I am so unsettled about this whole thing. Trust me, we'll do it right. No way. Man, I wish I was covering the financial beat and covering this story, because it needs those eyeballs. It needs that national debate. It needs people talking about it. I mean, we've been able to handle, what, 18-month presidential run. We should be able to hang in 18 months with when it counts about our retirement and our lives and our grandchildren, our children's, and people work all their lives and things going up in smoke. I mean, that deserves our attention. I think the issues drive that sort of stuff, but you're always going to get different perspectives on what's going on. I mean, you roll an apple down the street, and one guy sees an orange, another guy sees a pear. I mean, that's just the nature of news media and humans. But the important thing is keep talking about it, dialogue, keep questioning, stay interested, stay engaged in stuff, because that's the only way we're going to make some, I hope, changes and learn from our mistakes. My gosh, if we can't learn from our mistakes, we're all wasting our time.
Thank you very much for a great session. I have one more job. On behalf of our organization, this is your pay. This is the OSHA coffee cup.
I can't take it.
Can't take it. That's it. It's only worth $5.
I'll take it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.